On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Can the NBA do anything about the tanking we're seeing across the league? And are the Spurs real title contenders against the Oklahoma City Thunder? And are the Boston Celtics rushing Jason Tatum back from Achilles tear? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, wait a minute, that doesn't look like Dan Devine. That looks like someone with even better hair. Wow. Dan has a lot of company here. Brian Windhorst from ESPN is joining us, and your hair does look fantastic, Brian.
A little bit of a Monday situation here, and a little under the weather, so I apologize for the froggy throat.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. We're coming in. This is after the All-Star break. We are going to do a little second half preview, kind of the big storylines that Brian, you and I are watching as we head into like the stretch run of the regular season. We're probably not going to do too much All-Star talk here. So if you're here for All-Star recapping and
why would you be?
Yeah, we're not going to big brain this All-Star weekend too much, I don't think. But we've got a few topics that we want to hit here. So this week's big number is $500,000, I should say. That is the fine that the NBA levied against the Utah Jazz last Thursday for what they termed as conduct detrimental to the league, a.k.a. tanking. And they also fined the Indiana Pacers $100,000 for strategically healthy
scratching. I think technically the Jazz were fined for player participation policy violations. So I don't know if that would be tanking. That would be a violation of that thing. And then whatever verbiage you used was what the Jazz got hit with. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So whatever it is, two big fines just came down from the league office on two teams that have been jockeying for ping pong balls to varying degrees. And after the All-Star weekend, I think the All-Star weekend was a success on some levels. Some others, I was just mostly interested in what Adam Silver would say about all of the topics, the hot topics around the league. And they're quite a bit, Brian. I took a lot of notes during his press conference. And I thought he was as strong as I've ever seen him in a press conference about this subject. I think he was as strong as he's been since for life with the Donald Sterling thing. So, Brian, I wrote down some things about his takes on the tanking stuff. And look, I'm not saying Adam Silver was just roasting teams or roasting the practice of this. He wasn't going David Stern at this, but compared to David Stern, nothing Adam Silver says is going to be roasting guys. I think he's very milquetoast compared to David Stern, right? But he said, quote, the incentives are not necessarily matched here. He called the incentives backwards. That doesn't make sense. It's so clear that the incentives are misaligned. Are we seeing behavior that is worse this year? Yes, in my view. Re-examining the whole approach to how the draft lottery works, you have the incentive to perform poorly to get a better draft pick. It's time to take a fresh look at this to see whether there's if this is an antiquated look about going about doing it. We've got to look at some fresh thinking. What we're seeing is now is not working. And then maybe the most interesting one to me, but I don't think that's the way to manage the system long-term of, I know it when I see it. It will lead to very unhealthy relationships between us and our team. So, Brian, I know at the Hoop Collective, you have said you are doing a self-imposed gag order on all this tanking stuff, but I'd imagine you might have some thoughts here, and this is an away game here on The Big Number, so I feel like you can weigh in on some of these things. What'd you make of Adam Silver's comments?
Well, you always have your seven-point plan for fixing things, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners and viewers probably have them alone. I feel like a lot of people, you know, I will talk about tanking and they'll be like, oh, what you got to do is you got to, you know, do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. You know, here's my seven-layer plan. And a couple of things. One, you heard, I didn't realize this, that Adam said, I assume he's correct. I didn't check I'm sure it was researched beforehand, but he said that the lottery system has already been changed 5 times since it was introduced. So the lottery system came in 1984, I believe, 83 or 84.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, famously, the initial system was just the envelopes, however many there were. I don't remember how many there were, but 10 or 12 envelopes, whatever it was. And Stern stuck his hand in there. And, allegedly one of them was frozen. And that's how he picked the Knicks. You know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I don't believe that. But so there's been 6 material changes, right? The lottery system itself being done, and then 5 changes. This will, in theory, be the 6th change. So 7 different layers to the lottery system. And I, with that understanding, I posit that it is not fixable, that you can mitigate it, and that you can, there'll be a leak that springs, and you can put your hand down on that, but another leak will spring over here. And there's 4, what I call my 4 pillars to the NBA system that you have to understand. And I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, if you think I'm leaving something out or you don't like any of this, but before you bring forth your, whether it's you, Tom, or your listeners, before you bring forth your, inspired fix to lottery that you and your buddies and your people on your text chain think are going to fix it, here's why it ain't been fixed, and here's why it probably is not going to get fixed. These are the 4. I think most of the suggestions will run into a problem of these 4 things. Please, before I say them, correct me if you think I'm wrong. Number 1, star player, whatever you want to call it, has a disproportionate effect on basketball than the other sports. Right?
Correct.
Shohei Ohtani, we've never seen before in our lifetime, right? Pitches, starting pitcher when he's healthy, and hitter, right? Doesn't even play defense. We'll just put defense aside, but hitter and pitcher, like, can only pitch every 5 days, can only bat 4 or 5 times a game on average, right? The overwhelming majority of the game, the ball is not in his hand.
The Angels didn't make the playoffs famously while he and Mike Trout were outrageously good.
Right.
You had Babe Ruth and Ted Williams on the same team.
Exactly.
And they didn't get anywhere.
Correct. Because it's always so much, a quarterback, Tom Brady only plays half the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basketball is unparalleled in this in terms of team sports. So the value of a player is not even comparable to anything else. What disproportionate value of a star player is, and the thirst and the chase for it cannot be compared to other sports. 2, the NBA is a socialistic system. The wealthy teams transfer money to the non-wealthy teams, relatively speaking. And the teams that are the best teams have a system set up to share new talent with the weaker teams. System obviously can be manipulated, but that is the system. There are 30 teams, and while there are some people who would love it to be an 8-team league, it is a 30-team league, and the system is set up for those top-heavy teams, whether it's with talent or with money, share it. It's a sharing system. 3, the NBA is very much a data-driven product and league. Okay. The teams, maybe not every single one, but overwhelmingly, now will use data to make decisions. They will identify the incentives and play to the incentives.
They will moneyball the F out of this. Yes.
Absolutely. And not only that, but not only do you have just about every team with a multi-layer strategy department, the owners, by and large, not every owner, but so many of the owners made their fortunes following this type of value system, and so they are, very adept to leaning into incentivization. Okay. 4, the NBA is a revenue first operation. This is what, this is why all those years you would say to me, here's my plan for playing 50, 66, 71, 96, 23 games.
Yeah,
it can be the greatest plan in the history of planning.
Yeah.
It is on the premise of the fewer games is that the NBA's number one priority is quality. With peace and love, it just ain't. Okay.
Yeah.
The NBA, it's not that the NBA doesn't care about quality. Okay. It's just that it comes behind quantity. The NBA is a volume first business, and that means it is a revenue first business. Case in point, in this long press conference where Adam Silver, as you say, is being very strong on tanking, he openly admits they're about to expand. And that, so how many teams we got tanking, Tom? Do we debate 7, 10, 13?
As many, I would say upwards of 10. Yeah.
Whatever. They're not going to have, when they expand, they're not going to have two championships. Now, Adam would maybe argue that the NBA Cup is a championship, and so we've added a championship, and he would argue that. And that's not an unreasonable argument. However, you are now going to be having, if this goes through, 32 teams competing for the same set of prizes with the same things. And so I give you an example grade, you know, example A1A of revenue first, not quality first. Quality second. It doesn't mean they don't care at all about quality. It just comes behind quantity. And you've heard me say this, Tom, but I will say it again to you because it's one of my favorite things to say. Why does the NBA play best of seven? I've asked this to people for a decade and I've gotten great answers.
Why do they do that, Brian?
Because they can't get away with best of nine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those are my four tenets. It isn't like, you know, peer reviewed, as you know. But your tanking fix. Make sure it checks the boxes on those four, and if it does, now we got something, and I'll give you proper credit. I don't mean your whatever you're going to say to me, Tom, but that is
okay.
Okay.
Okay, so those four tenets, so one, superstars matter more in basketball. Two,
people will do whatever they possibly can to get their hands on them.
Right. Two, or is it three, the money ball, they're going to
find three is that they're the teams will find, are incentivized to find the, you know, any answer, and so they will lean into data. 1% chance of increase, an NBA team will do it because it's very largely a data-driven league.
And four is the
two is it's a socialistic system.
Yeah.
And four is that it's a revenue first league.
Okay. I think Adam Silver wants to kill the draft. That's what I think. I think he wants to get rid of it. I think
we're
going to
throw a flag and say that this is violation of rule two, which is that it's a socialistic system.
Okay.
And that the weaker teams, they live in a world where the weaker teams and the teams with less revenue rely on their partners to subsidize them, whether it's with talent. By the way, a rich team can have no talent, but they are at least given the opportunity, at least in the structure of the rules. They may, you know, piss it down their leg, but the structure of the rules promises the teams that are weaker and have less money. So I totally would just say, I'll listen to your getting rid of the draft, but just remember, 30 teams believe in socialism. And here's something else I will say. When you present this brilliant idea that you're about to present, which I'm sure it's brilliant, remember, it can be the greatest pitch in the history of modern sports. It can even follow those four tenets.
Yeah.
You can even, what you're about to present may hit them all because you're a super smart guy because you went to Wake Forest.
Oh God. Okay. Yeah.
23 owners got to say yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Not one, not 17, 23. So go ahead.
Whatever measures are being proposed, especially something as quote unquote radical as killing the draft.
Yeah.
It's 6 years. How many years out would that have to be with all the picks that are already outlaid in the NBA? The earliest it could happen. If Adam Silver said, all right, all 30 owners, we came to an agreement. We are going to kill the draft. We're going to go to rookie signing free agency period. And guess what? It won't happen until 2033. That's the earliest I'd imagine the NBA could enact.
I don't
this.
Think that's the reason it would not pass, but your point is correct. That is a challenge. I agree.
That teams are strategizing right now and have pick swaps, pick,
because it's a data, number three, it's a data driven league where teams search for all kinds of edges and incentives.
Right. So even if Adam Silver and all 30 owners and the league office and all the players came together and Wemby came together after some yoga and playing chess and said, I love this, this is brilliant, it likely would never happen until 2033 when all of the existing pick outlays are finished. So just forget about that for a second. What I'm proposing is you have cap exceptions for the records. So the worst records, the teams with the worst records have more spending power and thus have a financial advantage over the other teams. But if I'm AJ DeBonsa or Darren Peterson or last year Cooper Flagg, and I look at the Lakers and say, hey, I want to go play for the Lakers, but I also want to start. I want to play. I want to be a star. I'm never going to get the ball with the Lakers or the Knicks. Maybe they move mountains to make sure that they can go get Cooper Flagg. But I think there is going to be a balancing the distribution of that incoming talent. It wouldn't be that you see the Lakers, the Knicks, and the Miami Heat stacking talent, and that every Cooper Flagg that comes through the NBA is all going to go to those three markets. And I know this because what team does Darren Peterson play for right now?
Kansas.
A team in Lawrence, Kansas, right? AJ DeBonsa is not in New York or Miami or LA. Cooper Flagg went to Durham. Con Knipple went to Durham. Cam Boozer went to Durham. Where did Ace Bailey go? He went to Rutgers. Okay. The institutions in college basketball that have the same system of signing players rather than drafting them, they're not going to the metropolises on the coast. And I understand that people are worried that the Lakers and the Knicks and the Miami Heat would just stack all this talent. But we always talk about, hey, the Knicks are going to get every big free agent, and then they never come. When was the last time that a huge, I'm not talking about Jalen Brunson, a huge free agent said, I'm going to go play for the Knicks? Brian, when was the last time?
Amari Stoudemire, and he was their at least fourth choice in that class.
So I think there is a case to be made that even if you do kill the draft and you implement this salary cap system where the worst teams have more financial incentive, you don't have the tanking and you don't have the players are not going to just flock to the same system because incoming guys, they want to get paid and they want to be the star. They want to be the guy. They do not want to come into a system in which they're going to be the sixth man. So I will say all this. You can come back and say whatever you want. But I'm not saying this idea is perfect. What I'm saying is, if you truly want to get rid of tanking, and it sounded like Adam Silver does want to get rid of tanking, and Joe Vardon of The Athletic reporting afterwards that this idea of getting rid of the draft lottery system altogether has been floated in the league office, has not been presented to the competition committee, but it's at least floated. And I think Adam Silver is fed up about this. I think it drives them nuts. And I don't necessarily think it's about the owners. I think it also has to do with the gambling partnerships and just having teams where you don't know who's playing on a given night. You don't know if they're going to play 15 or 20 minutes. And I think that's a problem in of itself, is that I think a lot of the partnerships they've made, they're having trouble being able to say, yeah, we have these injury reports and you can 100% trust them. And then when the game starts, it kind of goes out the window. They just don't know. So I think one of the solutions here, and I don't agree with all these half measures of take away pick protections or you can't draft top five in multiple years. I think all those, they don't get at the root of the problem. We got to do a root canal here, Brian.
Maybe. I think with the money, the problem with manipulating, the idea of a draft, number one, again, seven teams would have to say no and it's done. It's done. Actually, I guess eight would have to say no and it's done. And like San Antonio, they got Tim Duncan and Victor Wembanyama by winning the draft lottery. The Spurs are voting no. Okay, for example, the Cleveland Cavaliers, built championship teams by winning the lottery. The Cavaliers are voting no. I think it wouldn't be very hard to get to eight votes. But beyond that, the challenge of the idea of a straight capitalism system is that I think players, because they can make so much in the NBA, I'm sorry, in college, will just wait. They will, AJ DeBonsa is not giving up money that much by if he were just to stay at BYU or go to the highest bidder. And that's why I think that's a challenge, because that
I think we're pretty close to that, by the way. I think if AJ DeBonsa, if the Sacramento Kings get the number one pick and they say, we want AJ, I think we're seeing an Eli Manning, John Elway situation.
I wouldn't, not speaking about AJ specifically, but, I know. I don't know if the number that he got from BYU is even public, but I know it's a very large number. So otherwise he wouldn't be at BYU, with all due respect. So I think that's the problem, is that a player could very easily manipulate it. And again, I'll go back to the socialistic system. I don't think the non-draft is getting past the rule of 23. You got to have 23 yeses. Even if you can present a really good plan, I just think there's too many teams who believe that they would not have a shot at it. You know, Indiana is like, how the hell are we going to get, you know, a big time player? We will never be able to pay. No one will ever choose us. We have to go through the draft. We got Paul George through the draft. We got, we traded for Tyrese Halliburton. You know, we're going to have to, we need to be protected. We vote no. Mm-hmm. I just think I could be wrong.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Can I ask you something? Where would LeBron go?
When he was,
St. Vincent and St. Mary's.
Back in 2003 or today?
2003, there's a free agency model, no draft. Is he still going to Cleveland?
No. The Knicks and the Clippers. I mean, I don't know how excited he would have been about being in the Clippers. In that particular case, his shoe deal, which was already very lucrative. I think his shoe deal was guaranteed $87 million, I believe. I've written extensively, reported extensively about it. I think it was $87 million. A lot of people said it was $100. It wasn't. I mean, but he ended up hitting a bunch of bonuses. But he had an escalator clause in his contract that would have amped up his shoe deal significantly higher, because he made the shoe deal before the lottery, and which was smart, because he was paid a high amount before he knew where the market was. Had he gotten to New York, I think I should go back and look at LeBron's rookie salary. I believe it was in the $3 to $4 million range. So again, if we're talking about 2003 time, he probably would have gotten, he would have probably gotten $3 or $4 million per year more just by whatever is in the Nike contract. So
you're saying LeBron, if he could choose where he was,
he would not have chosen Cleveland. I mean, assuming that he could just have picked the teams in the lottery, like if that's just how you want to frame it, if he could have picked any of the 29 teams, I think there was 29 when he came in. If he could have picked any of the 29, that's an even a wider conversation. But if he could have only picked from the 14 that were in the lottery, I believe he would have picked either New York or the Clippers. He might have, the Bulls were in the lottery too. He might have picked the Bulls. I do not believe he would have picked the Cavs. No.
Okay, because this is one of the arguments also, is that wouldn't Nike just drive the player to wherever they wanted them to go?
At the time, that was the case. In today's market, this is a whole other topic, but basketball shoes are not selling like they did back then. It is currently not fashionable to wear basketball shoes when you're not playing basketball. Obviously, I realize some people do it, but fewer people do it, which is why shoe deals are way down. The number of players getting shoe deals and the shoe deals themselves are way, way, way down from where they were back then. So it's a different, he came in, yes, he was extremely highly desired athlete, but he also came in this era of where there was just four shoe companies that were desperate to get him. And there's bigger stuff going on. For example, in China right now, there is a broad base, sentiment towards homegrown things against the West that is, you know, largely been done by President Xi, which has nothing to do with Nike, it has nothing to do with LeBron, has nothing to do with anybody he said on social media. It is, you know, several billion people are more leaning into Chinese culture than Western culture, which was not the case 20 something years ago. And so even if LeBron was cloned and the same set of circumstances came now, the shoe money just wouldn't be as big, because the shoe money is different. But in that particular situation, taking the 2003 snapshot, if it was this no draft system, the Cleveland wouldn't have got him. And the fear of that kind of situation, I believe, and I can't prove this because it's not like I've gone out and had the conversations with every team. It's just my feel, because the small markets are protected by the socialistic version of the system, anything that leans to a market-driven player situation, because obviously a team like Memphis can't win a market-driven chase for players. Now, you may say that they can, because if Memphis hoards their cap space and gets into a draft where they've got $27 million in cap space and the Knicks have $7 million in cap space.
And the keys to the franchise, which is, I think, a key, an important
in theory. I mean, again, you're selling the theory to the 30 owners. You're selling a theory there. But a team like Memphis, a team like Cleveland, a team like San Antonio, New Orleans, you know, they Milwaukee, they block vote. You got to sell 23 of them that leaving a socialistic system of player sharing for a straight open market system will benefit them. You can do it, Tom. You have a degree in economics. I don't doubt that you could create a white paper that would be compelling.
Bob Silver was citing economists in the speech. He said, hey, economists would say this is we have the old incentive structure backwards.
Sell it to Herb Simon, is what I'm saying. Sell it to Herb Simon.
Yeah.
Sell it to Gail Benson. You know, sell it to the, Dan Gilbert. You know, those are the people that got to say yes. It's a room of 30. It's not the MIT conference. You know, that's an important thing to remember. And I don't mean to be a Scrooge. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm just trying to operate in reality.
Yeah, you're pragmatic about this, and knowing the ownership group is very much for a system in which you can be really bad one year, and without having to do anything, you can have a shot at Cam Boozer, right? And the question is whether that system has more negative externalities than the one I'm proposing. And I'm sure people could come up with, oh, you didn't think about this part of the equation, but X, Y, and Z. But I think what I heard from Adam Silver in that press conference was they're going back to the drawing board and they want to do something wholesale changes to the lottery system. But I don't know if it's going to happen for another 5 years. And I don't know if he can get the votes. And we don't have to watch Hamilton to understand you got to get the votes in order to enact change. I do think that it's the time in the calendar, Brian, which I think you might be as tired as I am sometimes, is there's no football. So everybody who's just tuning into the NBA now has this grand theory about how to fix the NBA. But after the break, I want to bring a couple more items in this conversation that has hogged headlines about tanking in the NBA. Some interesting little angles here that I've discovered coming up right after the break here, Brian. Brian Windhorst from ESPN is joining us here. We're talking about the storylines that are going to hog the headlines for the next few months as we wind down the regular season. I'm wondering what the Utah Jazz would feel about what the Washington Wizards did on February 1st and February 5th. Same exact thing that the Utah Jazz did. They quiet quit, Brian. And this is when you play your stars or play your best players, and then you pull them as soon as you have an opportunity. If it looks like you're going to win the game, you're up 5 and late in the third quarter, and you pull your guys out of the game. And that, in essence, is what we saw Adam Silver come down hard on the Utah Jazz and saying February 7th game against Orlando, February 9th game against the Miami Heat, a game in which they won, by the way, that Adam Silver said, hey, you did not play Jaren Jackson Jr. and Lauri Markkanen and otherwise could have because they were medically cleared to do so. Will Hardy would disagree with that. But just for purposes of what is happening around the league and the Utah Jazz feeling the brunt of this punishment, in against the Sacramento Kings, the Washington Wizards pulled Chris Middleton, Keyshawn George, Bilal Coulibaly in the third quarter up 8, pulled all the starters, didn't play them the rest of the game. 4 days later, they're up against the Detroit Pistons, the best team in the Eastern Conference. They're up by 4 in the middle of the third quarter and pulled all their guys and they didn't come back. And unfortunately for the Washington Wizards, they won by 9. The Sacramento Kings also did this before the Utah Jazz. They pulled their guys, Doug Christie pulled their guys, Russell Westbrook, DeMar DeRozan, who by the NBA's definition is a star. DeMar DeRozan was pulled midway through the third quarter in interest of playing, quote unquote, developing the young guys and letting him close. And I think it's interesting, Brian, that the NBA after all that happened with the other teams, they came out hard on the Utah Jazz and used them as a sacrificial lamb here to say, look, we got to stop this right now. The Utah Jazz, $1 million fine. Indiana Pacers, sitting Pascal Siakam when you've played just about every single game this year, we're going to hit you with a fine too. So what do you make of what the Pacers and the Jazz would say in recognition that a lot of teams are doing this, but they didn't get the hammer? And I think Adam Silver mentioned this. It's like, we're using a system of when you see it, and I think it's going to lead to some unhealthy relationships around the league. And I think what he's getting at is, we don't really have a way to delineate between what Utah did and Sacramento did and what Washington did, but we gotta punish them somehow, you know? And so what do you say if you're the teams that got hammered with these fines when other teams are doing the same thing?
The Utah Jazz have an absolute spectacular defense. Like they have a defense in a trial. They have an absolutely wonderful, well-constructed, you know, with foundation defense for what they've done, and they are still guilty. And so that is essentially what Adam Silver is saying. And he's sort of like saying, like, the, I think he even used the same word that the Supreme Court used with the definition of obscenity. How do you define obscenity? Not that I'm trying to say that, you know, tanking is equivalent to something obscene. But he said, I know it when I see it. And that's essentially, you know, the crazy thing about it is that the Jazz, knowing that this fine, they may not have exactly known what the fine was, but they knew they were in quote unquote trouble because they had called in their people to, you know, they had been called to the carpet to testify. And so the Jazz put out a press release that Jaren Jackson is having knee surgery. Press release put out, not like leaked to some reporter. Like, they put out a press release, Jaren Jackson's having knee surgery. And by the way, like, you know, it's one thing to like shut a guy down with a sore back. Like, this is, they said what it was, which is this rare thing, which is he had a growth in his knee. They put out that press release saying Jaren Jackson has a growth in his knee and he is getting it taken out. We are actually opening our $200 million player's body. And the NBA looked at that press release and not only fined him the $500,000, but said it was because they put Jaren Jackson on the bench. Yep. Basically, they said, we don't care. So this is the problem with the Jazz's defense, is that the NBA doesn't care. They've decided that they're guilty, which they are. And the problem about the whataboutism is just that. And so basically what Adam is saying is, we're going to fine you, we're going to fine the Jazz $500,000, which I know Ryan Smith did not like when my colleague Bobby Marks said that it was nothing. Of course, it's not nothing. Of course, you know, sure, some budget within the Jazz will have to be cut because this fine is there, but the amount of the fine is insignificant to the Jazz's, you know, revenue, overall revenue. The point of the fine is a shot across the bow, not only at the Jazz, but at the whole league. And
do
then
you think
Adam
work?
To everybody. Well, I'm sorry. Did I think it'll work? Well, then Adam Silver rattled the saber, right? He got up there on that podium and he went, and I think it was David Aldridge said, could they take draft picks? You're darn right we could. I honestly don't think.
He's you know. Omar whistling through the neighborhood. Omar coming,
yeah. Yeah. You know, and like, he, you know, to use Adam Silver's parlance, he's given broad powers, you know. The truth is he can do whatever he wants. So he's basically saying, don't try me on this. While I figure out what we're going to do here, don't try me on this. Mm. And so, honestly, I just think that it's, again, I'll go back to my tenet number three. It's a data-driven league. Teams will figure out ways to get to the incentive. And right now, they're plotting on ways that they can still get to the incentive.
Right. So
they're all smart.
Like I said, teams are doing this, what Utah did. And what I think Will Hardy mentioned was that they were medically, Lauri Markkanen couldn't play. He was on a minutes restriction, and that's why we pulled him. I wonder if like
the problem with that, I want to pick apart the Jazz thing because, like I said, their defense is good.
Yeah.
You can't say after the game that a player was on a minute restriction, especially when he's a star player, because now you're throwing a flag. Now you're into the betting situation.
This is what I was getting at, Brian, is I think we might have a new designation in the injury report, which is just limited. He's going to play, but we're going to play this star in limited minutes to just give everyone a heads up that like he's going to play 25 minutes rather than 35 minutes, or he's going to play 19 minutes instead of 29 minutes. And I wonder if we're moving towards that. It's a Band-Aid. This is not going to solve a huge leg wound here that the NBA is going to think about. I'm proposing an amputation. I'm saying we can't save the leg here. We can't put a Band-Aid on it. What I think a Band-Aid might be is a provision that says, all right, well, on the injury reports now, if you're planning to just play your guy 20 minutes like Anthony Davis did in New Orleans before the That's All folks, and just say, we're not going to play you in the fourth quarters, we're just going to play you for 20 minutes and call it a day. I think we might be entering that zone where, at this point in the season, if you're planning on playing LeBron James only 20 minutes, then say something on the injury report.
I'm just going to tell you, there's a whole bunch of people in the league office who went to Ivy League schools that are trying to figure out what the rules are, should be. And there's a whole bunch of people working for teams who went to Ivy League schools or the equivalent who are going to figure out ways to get around it.
Yep.
And I want to believe that there's a magic bullet, that there is a rule change that can be enacted that'll make it work. But I am unfortunately skeptical that that's the case.
Let's move to someone who did use a lot of these draft lottery gifts and win a lot of games using that. Victor Wembanyama and Dylan Harper and Stephon Castle, three guys who were the Spurs moved up in the lottery to get those guys. And now they're on the verge of potentially going to the Western Conference Finals way earlier than everyone expected. And I'm saying Western Conference Finals because right now they're two games back in the loss column with the Oklahoma City Thunder. They've won the season series against the Thunder. After the Thunder, I was sitting here saying, maybe they're going to win 75 games, Brian. I think they might break the record. And then 2 months later, we're saying, wait a minute, are the Spurs actually going to be better than the Thunder and beat them in the playoff series? And they're going to be in the NBA Finals? I'm wondering, Brian, because I think this does dovetail in the conversation of the draft lottery and trying to fix everything with tanking. One of the reasons why tanking is so effective is because not just you get Victor Wembanyama, you get Victor Wembanyama for less than Kelly Olynyk right now.
That's right.
On the Spurs books, if you look at the contracts, Kelly Olynyk who barely plays for the Spurs. He's their third big man. He makes more money this season than Victor Wembanyama, who might end up winning the MVP.
Yeah.
So the rookie scale contract is a huge reason why you see not just teams tanking, but being like, how do we, $500,000 fine? Great. Because over the next 10 years, if we get a Wemby, if we hit a LeBron, if we hit a Cooper Flagg, we're going to be profiting $100 million in the first 4 years of that. We'll gladly pay. This was, remember at ESPN when you did the thing about how Anthony Davis, if he gave everyone a Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, I argued that if you know, there's 100 voters, I argued that it would have been good business for him literally to bribe. he could have given everybody 100. He could have given every voter $50,000 equivalent, and it would have still been an incredibly smart deal.
Because of the All-NBA vote and the Supermax.
Because it was the All-NBA, getting All-NBA was worth $35 million.
Exactly.
Whatever it was, yeah.
So I think people need to understand that Victor Wembanyama is awesome, but Victor Wembanyama making $11 million this year and $16 million next year is why this is so transformative in getting a Wemby, right? And so I'm wondering,
and I would,
Brian,
even take it one step further, that even Victor Wembanyama at the 25%, okay, Victor is probably going to get the 30% max, but you know, if you get a player at the 25% max, even though that's the value proposition isn't quite as hugely in your favor. But even, you know, go back and look at when the Cleveland Cavs were building, when they had LeBron James at the 25% max in year five, that was still an incredible discount. You know, for example, it's, you know, LeBron was not the highest paid player on his own team, the single highest paid player until his 11th season. So the value of having that player on those lower deals, it remains even beyond your rookie contract. But obviously the outsized value is in the rookie contract. And I'll go back to, you know, tenet number one, which is the, you know, the outsized value of a superstar player in basketball.
Who's leading the league in blocks, and then also 23-10 for his career, and also shoots threes. I mean, he's not even Tom Brady in the sense of he's a great quarterback. He's Tom Brady on the defensive end and Tom Brady off the floor.
Wasn't Tom Brady underpaid too? It didn't a big part of his career, he was underpaid,
mm-hmm.
which contributed to his value.
That's right. So
not to mix sports.
I think, Brian, what I want to ask you is, knowing OKC and the situation that they're in, where they've only had 5 games with Isaiah Hartenstein, their playoff lineup, starting lineup. They've only had 5 games because of injuries to J-Dub and now Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I'm wondering, do you have any, what's your level of concern here with OKC hearing the footsteps behind them? Wemby's footsteps, very large footsteps, by the way. Do you think the Thunder are as vulnerable as I think they are? I had them on the top of my title tiers. No one next to them up until now. I've finally said, all right, Shai's out with an abdominal strain, whether that's a real injury or not. They just wanted to buy him a two-week break. I don't know. But given the fact
that's a real injury. I don't know if it's a 2-week injury, but he was struggling when he went out.
So the Spurs are 2 games back in the loss column. They've handily beaten OKC this season. And Wemby looks like he is on a mission right now. He's got 3 games left four games left before his All-NBA eligibility and Defensive Player of the Year eligibility expires, because I think he's missed 14 games. I think there's a weird quirk where, because he played in the NBA Cup Final, it counts towards
By the way, that rule, the 65-game rule has some caveats in it that the league can bend a little bit if they want to. They haven't bent it yet, but just know that, you know, to use Adam Silver's parlance, there's broad powers. To do that.
What's your concern level with OKC right now?
Yeah, I know. I'm a subscriber to The Finder. So let me ask you this. People are going to listen to this and think that I'm this like one of these dogmatic people. You know, I have Brian's guiding principle of the NBA is actions over words. So let me ask you this. Do you believe the Spurs believe they can beat him?
Yes.
Then why didn't they do anything at the deadline?
It's a great question. I've wondered the same thing. How do we know that they didn't try to do things?
Good retort. I don't have enough evidence to be able to say that, because the Spurs were uniquely positioned to, and I understand that the Spurs want to play the long game. If the Spurs thought that they could, I mean, I think the Spurs love their chances, you know, relatively to where, especially where they were at the start of the season. I mean, they have to love where their chances are. But I question if the Spurs really believe that they can do it. Their actions make me not be able to say that. And again, now I'm not saying Mitch Johnson would say that. I'm not saying that Brian Wright, their GM, would say that if he had a microphone in front of them. But their actions make me wonder if they think this is the year or not. The other thing they'll say is—
Right, because they traded for De'Aaron Fox and he was injured. They sat him out last year and then he got ready for this year. So they obviously are swinging, right? Whether they're going for a grand slam or a home run swing, that's the distinction you're making. That they want De'Aaron Fox because they think they're in the window. But whether they really believe that this is the year to go all in, you're saying they did not push.
And they did the De'Aaron Fox deal because they liked the value of that trade at the time. I think they said, you know, for what we're giving up here, you know, quite frankly, I don't want to be offensive, but when you can do a deal with the Kings, you know, teams are like, let's do this deal with the Kings. Like, you know, most of the deals that have been done with the Kings in recent memory have been favored by the other team. So I think part of it was, you know, maybe they did look to do a deal and they, you know, there was a certain value that they wanted. Maybe their threshold for value in a trade in Victor's early years is higher. But 2 things. One, the reason that the Spurs, in my view, you can disagree with me, the numbers may disagree with me, but the reason that the Spurs have given the Thunder so many problems this year is because the strength of the backcourt. It's not so much the front court led by Wick and Wembanyama. It's what the Spurs backcourt can do to the Thunder. And even maybe more accurately, how they can handle the way the Spurs or how they can handle the way the Thunder attack you, which is to come at you in waves and to try to basically force you into mistakes. And with 3 excellent ball handlers that can play both ends, the hand that they're holding is particularly strong against Oklahoma City. But the other thing I'll say is none of the injuries that Oklahoma City has, as far as we are aware, you know, in February is season ending. You know, the Rockets, for example, I mean, I will allow for the 1 in 100 scenario that Fred VanVleet comes back. I just don't think they can count on him. But they've lost. They've lost two starters. You know, Steven Adams is done for the year. Fred VanVleet very likely done for the year. Like, Jalen Williams has barely been able to play. You know, Hartenstein has not played that much. But none of those injuries, to our knowledge, is season ending. So the level that the Thunder can still hit this year is still, in my view, relatively high.
Yep.
Also, and this was funny, I was on ESPN last week and we got in this exact conversation with Kendrick Perkins. And I just said, you know, I'm kind of in this era, Tom, where I've been around a little bit. I've got some gray here. Mm. You know, this is my 23rd year covering the NBA. And so, and yet I don't think I'm a stick in the mud yet. Maybe another year or two I'll get there. I'd like to think that I'm still open-minded. But I've just been around long enough to know that teams that don't have experience, they don't tend to win 12 playoff games. Now, there are obviously examples that you can provide where a team has gone from zero playoff wins as a group to 12. Because really what we're talking about is 12. Can you win the Western Conference? And one of the things about the NBA is the difference between winning 8 playoff games and 12 and 16 is enormous. You know, it's players don't think that it is. Players are like, you know, I remember, you know, Durant was particularly eloquent on this.
Yes.
Famously, mm-hmm. when his toe was on the line in 2021, his toe is on the line. If it's a 3, the Nets win and go forward to the conference finals. Instead, the Bucks get a reprieve, go to overtime, win that game, win the conference finals, win the finals. And many people were said, The Nets win the championship if Durant is 1 inch back. And Durant called bull on that because he said the difference between winning 8 and 16 is enormous. And, you know, Kyrie is out and Harden is dragging his leg up the court. We would not have won. And so my thing is, and I can't quantify this. No. I can't say, well, the Spurs are not going to win 12 because of A, B, C, D. But I just know that you can't just say, they're ready to do it, and they just do it.
100%.
Typically, it takes getting bashed across the nose because no matter what a team looks like, you can't the playoff the it's disproportionate. 4 extra wins, the difference between 4 to 8 is not the same as between 8 to 12. It just ain't. And so Perk and I got into a disagreement because he's really a believer in the Spurs as well. And I'm a big believer in Wembanyama. I mean,
you were there. You were literally there from day one.
Just want to take the idea that Wembanyama can't do anything off the table. I don't want to argue against it, but young guards and inexperienced guards, and in the case of De'Aaron Fox, he's still inexperienced playoff-wise. I realize that when he did play in the playoffs, that series against Golden State, it wasn't like he laid down. I the guy's clutch player of the year. I'm not saying that he's like not going to be able to deliver.
Right, but it's not a Kyrie situation where he's won an NBA championship with a big shot in the NBA finals, one of the biggest shots ever, right? It's different when it's the first round versus the NBA finals.
Right. So I go through this on air. We have this back and forth between me and Perk where I raise the issue that I'm worried about the Spurs inexperience and that I think that will show up. And therefore, I would favor the Oklahoma City Thunder because of their experience.
Sure.
And Perk basically argues, he's like, have you seen Stephon Castle? Like, this guy is a beast. You know, you see how De'Aaron Fox plays. Wembanyama can do anything. Like, he really is going back and forth. And so we go to commercial, and the guy on set who's got a, you know, Perk has a ring as a player, and the guy on set who has a ring as a coach, Michael Malone, says, you know what? You're right. Very rarely do teams, you know, without experience do it. Like, he kind of sided with me off air. Of course, which was on air, but,
thanks,
you know,
Michael.
I am open to the possibility that San Antonio can do it, but I don't. I don't believe that they're going to do it.
Yep.
I would love it if they did. I would like nothing more than to be let the Victor Wembanyama era begin because I think it's inevitable. But I'm worried about the experience, and I just wonder if deep down in their hearts the Spurs are too, because I think if they really thought, I think they would have gone for a short-term decision.
It's an open race. I don't think I was there a month ago, but I'm there now, is that it's an open race.
Well, and you saying that is meaningful. Like, that's not nothing. I mean, you're not saying it flippantly.
Yeah, and I think the other side of it too in the East is really interesting. We have the Jason Tatum promo that he did with the NBC over the weekend during All-Star Week, a little behind-the-scenes video vignette about his rehab from his Achilles tear. And I also think this is part of the math for me. The calculus is if OKC is limping right now, and an abdominal strain, you and I covered Chris Bosh in Miami. An abdominal right. strain is the real deal. And I don't know, what was it? At least through the All-Star break was the prognosis from the Oklahoma City Thunder. We don't know too much more about it. But I remember sitting in that Miami room and Brian, you and I looking at each other and saying, I think this could be the end of the Miami Big Three.
I remember the look on Chris's face when he suffered the injury. There was a camera because he suffered the injury. He sort of fell down and was in the paint. He was on all fours looking at the baseline. And I remember the camera picked up his eyes. I remember his eyes indicated to me that he was hurting. He was like, whoa, this really hurt. Yeah, they were down. They were down to Boston.
Well, Boston and then,
was it Boston they were down to? I remember they played Boston. They beat Boston.
He came back
in seven.
Against KG in the next series, but Indiana's when Spo hit the Shane Battier button. Well, it was also Dexter Pittman, and that was famously unsuccessful starting Dexter Pittman. But what Spo wanted to do was go Shane Battier at the four and be a punching bag for David West. And he believed
poor
that. Poor
Shane. Poor Shane.
In the middle of that series, I was just like, I'm physically hurting because David West is throwing him around like a rag doll. And eventually, Spo's decision, because you know what Pat Riley wants to do. He wants to go big. You know, he's the guy, 3 feet in a cloud of dust. He wants to just play big physical basketball. And he has won championships with some of the greatest centers of all time. The idea of starting Chris Bosh or Udonis Haslem at the five and going small with Shane Battier at the four was obviously unconventional. But eventually, when we get to the NBA finals and Chris Bosh comes back against KG and the Boston Celtics and then wins the East and they go against Kendrick Perkins, the aforementioned Kendrick Perkins, and they win by going small. I think he was vindicated, but it was hanging on by a thread. And it's, you know, hindsight is 20/20, Brian, but you and I both know covering those teams, it was teetering from exploding off of that abdominal strain. So that's what I'm saying, the backdrop of the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander thing.
By the way,
so
quick
far,
aside,
we don't think it's that serious.
As a quick aside, I remember Shane when he was in those years where he was playing four and he was just a punching bag, you know. And he would sit in a cold tub after every game with his legs. He just, you know, to try to like deal with the pain and the suffering that he was going through with his legs. So he'd sit in the cold tub. And not just the ice bucket, like he would go sit in the cold tub. And then if the Heat were flying after those games, which back in those days, there was more back-to-backs, almost all the Heat flights were long because Miami's way at the corner of the country. So Shane would put on compression pants that were very uncomfortable. And back then, by the way, guys were traveling in like suits, right? So Shane, you know, let's say he has a game where he's, you know, he's playing the four and he just gets beat to hell by, you know, a 6'10", you know, 230-pound guy for 36
like Paul
minutes.
Paul Millsap, David West.
Yeah. And so then he goes and he sits in the cold tub to get his legs somewhat back. And then he has to put on those compression, you know, I just remember seeing him putting them on. They look painful. And now he's got to wear it, you know, for 3 hours where they fly to the back-to-back to, you know, Brooklyn or New York or Toronto, because they did that all the time. They had back-to-backs in Miami to up the East Coast, Washington all the time. And then he'd have to put on like, you know, dress pants and go to the airport.
And he's what, 35?
Yeah, he's up there. He was nearing retirement. And
getting
so,
closer,
you know,
by the day, by the minute.
Yes. I just remember, you know, seeing Shane go through that routine, you know, for the good of the order. To try to like keep the swelling down so that he could go out the next night and play power forward again. But it worked. My God, did it work for the Heat. I mean, it was very valuable, him doing that. And by the way, he was playing for less than market. He took less money to play in Miami. And he won two rings. Like, I don't think he regrets it for a tenth of a second, but you know, just going down memory lane.
When that happens, we can see that the injury return was miraculous for Chris Bosh, saved the season. And
the three pointers in game seven, right?
Yep. And happily ever after. All right, we'll be right back after this break. I'm a little nervous about Jason Tatum with the Boston Celtics, and I'll tell you what. Kobe Bryant tried this in 8 months, come back from his Achilles tear, much older than Jason Tatum now. It did not go well for Kobe Bryant. He played 6 games, I think it was, and then fractured his leg, and then he was out for the season. Elton Brand, 28 years old, around the same age as Jason Tatum right now, was never the same after he tore his Achilles, his calf atrophy. After that Clippers, I think it was during training camp, I want to say, he tore his Achilles, came back within 10 months, and just was never the same player after that. On the other side of that, DeJounte Murray hasn't come back. And I don't know if you've heard it. I haven't heard anything. Is DeJounte, it's 15, 13
well,
months.
Well, what would the incentive be? I mean, I understand that they don't control their pick, but, you know, why would he risk it to, right. For what?
So the upside is what is that he comes back and plays a few games and just to be able to get out there heading into the offseason. Okay. Well, KD famously tore his Achilles in the NBA finals and took the whole season off. And it wasn't a situation, same apples to apples as we're seeing with Boston, of course, because they were restarting this whole project, this experiment in Brooklyn. It wasn't an existing thing that they hadn't already won a championship together with Jaylen Brown and the Boston Celtics. So I get that.
He had the complicating factor that he would have had to come back in the bubble, which, you know, he got a little bit of extra time because, you know, I guess the season, you know, season was delayed a few months, but I don't think he, you know, that was a factor. I'm not sure he, you know, was looking to for that experience either. So, but that was a factor that right I think it made it easier for him to say no, I think.
I think you're right about that. Right now we're at 10 months for Jason Tatum.
Yeah. No, 9 months, I think.
Well,
right?
9 months, he's at 9 months right now, right? Yeah. So it was May.
I looked it up the other day. It was May 12th. So we're just into the 10th month, I guess. We're not at fully 10th month. Yeah.
So I think it was Bill Simmons who was kind of like eyeballing all the random, you know, early March, maybe potentially early March stuff that he might be coming back and triangulating it that way. I'm just saying the history of Achilles tears are not definitively saying you should hold out the whole year and just come back with a full training camp and ramp up with your team and then get on that schedule. But maybe medically the technology is there is such that Jason Tatum can come back and still be at a high level without risk, outsized risk of re-injury, like in the case of Kobe Bryant, or long-term compromising your leg or the other leg in compensation and whatnot, like we saw with Elton Brand. Every data point is interesting, right? Not necessarily predictive. But Brian, given what you've seen in the NBA, these long timetables with an ACL or an Achilles tear, is there an example of something like Jason Tatum coming back in March and it working out well? And it's not that I've done this research and that I haven't found one, but is there a precedent here that you look back and you say, you know what, it actually worked out and everyone's happy that he did return to a team that is ascending right now in Boston?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember. Now let's go to the actions over words thing. So you say, well, what do the Celtics believe? The problem with looking at the Nikola Vucevic trade, I think the Celtics made that trade for more than just this season. I think they have interest in re-signing Vucevic. They couldn't have re-signed him. They wouldn't have had space to do it. So I think that was almost hedging between helping them now and also pre-agency. I don't think they were going to re-sign Anthony Simons, regardless of how good Simons was really, really good for them. But I think one of the reasons why they did the deal is I don't think they intended to re-sign him, whereas I think they would like to re-sign Vucevic. So I'm not going to take the fact that they, you know, quote unquote, bought at the deadline. So I'm going to put that aside. I will just say that, first off, your data on these things is often illustrative. Like you research this stuff and write about this stuff like nobody else. So I think that's relevant that you're sniffing out like some of the stuff. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Brad Stevens's group has done the same type of research, if not outwardly read yours. Also, I will just say that anecdotally, And, you know, I am not schooled in, you know, orthopedic recoveries. I don't know enough about, like, you know, there's this whole thing about where the Achilles breaks, whether it breaks high or low. And I'm not an expert on that.
Dr. Winhurst, I'm letting you slide on this one.
I just know that I've covered players who have torn their Achilles before. And routinely, I have heard them say, like, at the 6 or 7 month mark, I'm doing great. And then they get to the 9 or 10 month mark where it actually the finish line gets in sight, and it feels like a bigger hurdle. That's just anecdotally.
Sure.
Me, you know, having covered a few players. For example, I remember Mario Chalmers coming off a torn Achilles. You know, saying, you know, I'm doing great. You know, not that, you know, Mario.
No, Mario, I'm laughing because I think I've told you the Mario Chalmers story with me in the Heat locker room.
I don't remember.
Okay, I'll tell it
to you. I just remember that I genuinely did like his shoes.
And Spalding ones.
They were Spaldings. And I mean, okay, I'm a white guy, you know, who was in my 30s at the time. You know, I wasn't the target audience. I thought his shoes were cool. And I told him I thought his shoes were cool. And he and his teammates who heard it thought I was being patronizing. I wasn't being patronizing. I liked the way they looked.
Yeah.
What do you want me to say?
I don't know, knowing us white, sloppy looking 30 somethings, I don't think they're looking for us for fashion. Like, I don't think that's an endorsement.
I agree. Like,
you
know, I
if
always
you're running for president, do you really want?
That's the thing. Sometimes when people show off shoes, you know, and like there'll be a new shoe and they'll post on social and people will put the fire emoji. I don't know whether it's sarcastic or not.
Right.
And I haven't for many years. Because I don't understand what's happening. I thought his shoes looked cool, but apparently me giving that compliment was viewed as patronizing. But
Mario
Chalmers story is what?
Well, I think he was another 18-month guy, but his career
his career never recovered. But my point is, at 6 months, he thought he was clearly was close, mm-hmm. and the truth was he wasn't. Yeah. That's an example of a player, and I'm just using him as an example, because I don't want to put other guys on blast or whatever. But I believe I was saying this when people, you know, when Tatum was, you know, glimpsed at 6 months, like dunking or whatever, and people were like, oh my God, he might be back by Super Bowl Sunday. I was like, well, I hope that he is. Mm-hmm. But anecdotally, that is, and Kobe was insane. I don't think you can look at what Kobe did as a...
But Tatum ever. Does... Mamba mentality and look up to Kobe in ways that I think is inspiring for him. And so if he looks at Kobe Bryant coming back in 8 months, he might say, I want to beat that, or I want to do the same thing that he did. So my Mario Chalmers story is, in high school, I played at UNC basketball camp at Chapel Hill, and I played against some really good players. But we, during scrimmage week or scrimmage day, we were split up into teams, and I got to play with this kid from Alaska, and he was so good, and he was dunking on everybody, and he was the point guard at the same time. And I'm like, dude, are you getting looks at Chapel Hill? He's like, yeah, you know, I'm talking to coach. And he's like, I'm also looking at Kansas. And I'm like, what's your name? He's like, Mario. And I'm like, all right, Mario, this is great. We're gonna win this tournament. This is awesome.
Well, he was on your team.
He was on my team. Mario Chalmers and I were teammates.
I did not know this. I did not know this.
So Brian, I get the job covering the Miami Heat with the Heat Index at ESPN. And I am so psyched because Mario Chalmers is on the team, my teammate at camp. And surely he remembers me because I remember him, right? And so I'm like, okay, we won the tournament at the camp. And it was triumphant. I was going into my senior year in high school, and it was great. You know, I'll never forget it. Mario Chalmers and I, we're you know, dapping
bros,
up, we're hugging, and it's great.
Yeah.
I go into that Miami Heat locker room in training camp that year, and I'm so excited. I'm like, all right, I've already mapped out like what I'm going to ask him, like, da da da. And I go in there, and he's at his locker, and I go, yo, Mario, hey, it's Tom. Hey, remember a few years back, we were at Chapel Hill? And he just looks at me, and he goes, nah, man, I don't recognize you at all. I'm sorry. And I was so deflated, Brian. I've been thinking about this moment for weeks leading up to this moment. And he's like, you know how many like random white dudes I played with over the years?
You know,
and
you all I'm look like, the same.
all look the same. Like, he doesn't remember me. Of course he doesn't remember me.
Yeah, you're just a 6-foot guy with limited ball skills.
Exactly. And that's when I realized that's why Mario Chalmers is a millionaire and he's a pro and he's one of 450 and I'm one of 450,000. Right. The difference between Mario Chalmers basketball and me, high school kid who started his senior year but never even thought about playing D1.
Right. And keep in mind, Mario Chalmers is a 2nd-round pick. Like, this guy like blew you away. Like, oh my God, I've never seen a player like this. Oh my God. Went to Kansas and NCAA championship. Yep. 2nd-round pick.
Yeah. And didn't know who I was. And it was devastating. But hey, that year with Mike Bibby getting signed and starting the NBA finals and the redemption arc of Mario Chalmers was one of the coolest, underrated stories of the Miami Big.
Well, Mike Bibby, you know, Mike Bibby taught me something. You know, and I'm actually planning on, assuming my voice doesn't totally go away, I'm giving a speech in Akron, Ohio later this week, and I want to mention this. So hopefully this doesn't cross. But Mike Bibby taught me something. I don't know if you remember the press conference when Mike got signed. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
He had taken a buyout from the Hawks, and he left $5 million on the table. This was in 2011. Like, this was kind of unheard of. I mean, that number, I mean, you know, guys sometimes left a little bit of money on the table, but $5 million in 2011. I mean, the max salaries back then were like $15 million. So I don't remember exactly what he left, but he left a huge piece of money on the table. And I was desperate to get his explanation of why he thought it was worth leaving $5 million on the table to come play with the Heat, because he left, took $5 million. They, you know, he got a prorated minimum. He got a few hundred thousand, basically. And he basically told me politely, he was irritated, but he was polite. Don't count my money. And sometimes there's more important things than just money. And I took it to heart, you know. And I really have tried to avoid doing that. You know, we report on money because it's important in the NBA. It's a tenet of, like, you know, what leads to decisions and strategy and whatever. But I've never forgotten that. And you know, you never want to make an assumption of what different amounts of money mean to different people. Sometimes players will show us that they're very focused on either getting as much money as possible or focused on the situation over the money. But he basically gave me a lesson that day, which, you know, involved Mario and Mike Bibby, which just, you know, some of the players who came through that locker room in that first year,
Stack,
you know, Jerry Stackhouse, Eric Dampier
starting the year. Yep.
Yes. I learned a lot. I learned so much from covering that Heat team.
Can I tell you my Mike Bibby story?
Yeah.
Real quick, and I know you got to go.
But not real quick. That's fine.
Mike Bibby, I remember we were in the practice facility with the yellow walls, Miami Heat practice facility, right? And
this structure is Miami Heat practice gym. Whoever, I don't know who the architect was who designed this, but he designed the greatest practice gym in North America. There's a four story, you know, 50-foot window overlooking Biscayne Bay. It's absolutely, I guarantee there is not a practice facility in the NBA that looks like this, probably anywhere and within the arena. And he brings these players will shoot for their practice shots overlooking this. How wide is it, Tom? It's 200, you know, 150, 100 something feet wide, 50, 60 feet tall, incredible view of Biscayne Bay. Just jaw dropping with, you know, in the backdrop, you know, bridges, and in the backdrop, the skyscrapers on Miami Beach and the ocean beyond. My God.
Well, that's why Ray Allen hit the big shot, because he'd been practicing so much in the practice facility because he wants to be in the gym all the time, you know?
Riley ordered that window, sealed off in 1995. And that thing has not been, it's just like a white translucent, you know, covering on that window, and it ain't been opened in 30 years, Tom.
Oh my God.
That not in 30 years has that practice gym seen that view. Pat Riley was like, hell no,
no,
we're not having a practice gym that has the best view. We're not going to focus out there. We're going to focus in here, GD. Sorry, go ahead.
And as an aside, the Charlotte Hornets practice facility, the practice court, you literally, fans can watch the practice happen because it's right on the street level. And there's like very little like blinds. And I remember watching Dwight Howard practice free throws 7 minutes after the game ended. Fans are trying to peek in at watching Dwight Howard practice free throws. It's a very different situation there in Miami Beach. But Mike Bibby, I remember when he came, I was so excited to ask what it was going to be like for him to catch all of these driving kicks from LeBron and D-Wade and all the gravity that the big three were going to have. And he was going to be wide open for 90% of his shots. So I asked him, like, how excited are you that you're not going to have to work for anything? You're just going to have to stand there on the three-point line and they're just going to give you wide open shots. And he says to me, looks me right in the eye, he's like, I don't like open shots. I actually prefer when they're contested. And I said, holy shit. I'm going to look at this and look in the data. So I pull up, of course I did. I went into the data to see what his numbers
were.
He
was running back down the concrete hallway.
Brian, he was awful on open three-pointers. And we should have seen this coming. We should have seen that the Mike Bibby experiment did not work because the guy hated open threes. I don't know what Spo and Andy Ellisberg and Pat Riley, if there was a way that they could have seen this coming.
What happened was it was March and they were going to get like this player for like next to nothing. They didn't go to the point guard store and pick out the point guard that was perfect for open shots. They took the best thing they could get in March.
Yes, and it was Mike Bibby. So, well, Brian, I hope you feel better, and I hope the big number for you is all of the DayQuil and NyQuil that you're going to be taking to get better for your Akron appearance here.
I think I've got DayQuil in my pocket right now. There it is. I'm due.
There it is. I don't know how many you have to take there, but make sure you get that after the show. Brian, thanks so much for doing this. I know it's a All-Star weekend and it looks Omaha looks beautiful behind you. I just want to note that.
Miami. I wonder if this is akin to what the view would be. This is over Star Island.
Yep.
This is like the inverse. This is like looking at downtown, but this is akin to what the view would look like out the Heat practice facility and just picture Pat Riley going, nope, you are not. that's how Pat Riley says that the Heat practice facility is going to be.
Yeah. And let me get these pliers out here and just try to get your body fat there.
That's right.
While you're in the practice facility.
That's right.
That was for me. The backdrop, the Miami one.
That's correct.
Yeah. I'll never
some of our best years.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But I will say my beard not on Kendrick Perkins level. So you might say you've already had this conversation with Kendrick Perkins, and I would say he also.
But I think the coloring of your beard might be more genuine to its actual color than not to out Perk.
On the way out, I will have my hottest take is that LeBron should give in and have the gray beard because it would be so much cooler having a guy dominate, put a 30-point triple-double at age 41 with a Katino Mobley beard. You know, like I just feel like that would be historic if he just owned how old he is out there on the floor.
I agree. But, you know, he does play in L.A. And, you know.
Yeah. That's Brian Winterst over at ESPN. Thank you so much. Go listen to him at the Hoop Collective. I appreciate you fighting through that, Brian. And you are free to go now.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.